Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi.
We're mass communicating.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for them.
This is the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I gave it a 10.
Sweep the leg. You have a problem with that.
And now, here are your hosts, Rocky LaFleur.
Everybody on? Good.
Great. Grand. Wonderful.
No yelling on the bus.
Josh Webb.
Sorry I had a fight familiar, your butt at the party.
And Jake Latondras.
I am bad news.
Also starring Rob Kroon.
I bet this guy's into the woods $100.
And Bradley Ramsey.
No, Mark, didn't say it.
Showtime.
All right, here we go. Hold your ears, folks. It's showtime.
Showtime, everybody! Showtime!
Welcome to the End of the Line podcast. I'm Rocky LaFleur sitting in the Duck South Studios on this Wednesday afternoon. Of course, it's Wednesday. You know who's joining me? Bill Cooksey. Bill!
What's going on, man? We're back to rain.
I'm still suffering from the major prank that got pulled on me yesterday.
What was that?
Your buddy Rob Kroon decided to get me good.
Yeah.
So yesterday, so we're about to open the vet clinic here in Oxford, right?
Uh-huh.
Kind of a part of the story. So my wife was talking to AT&T. They want us to bundle all this stuff up together. We've been with C Spire for forever. So she basically says, yeah, we want our cell phones, internet, landlines, and cable TV. We can get it all through AT&T. They'll bundle it up for us, and it's cheap. So I gave her my phone. I said, listen, I've already recorded today. If anybody calls me, just tell them I'll call them back this afternoon. I'll get back with them. Gave her my phone. Mm-hmm. She went to AT&T. So come back from the farm. I said, I'll run by the store, pick up a new phone from me, because she's still working on some other stuff. She said, okay. So run back by the store. And she's got that toe tap going with the scrunch nose. You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah.
It's the look.
Mm-hmm. It's what I hate.
She said, you know, if it wasn't for you, I'd have been out of here 2 hours ago. What are you talking about? What's going on? She said, you didn't happen to tell me about the boat and the Toyota truck that you're selling. I'm like, what are you talking about? Are you trying to help somebody sell a boat and a Toyota truck? I'm like, no. So she picks up my phone. I even get the look from the AT&T salesman. I had gotten 120-something phone calls plus 67 text messages about a Toyota and some boat that's for sale on some barter and trade group or page in Arkansas.
With your number.
Yes. And wow. I finally get a hold of the ad. I said, in movie-esque terms, I swear this is how I play it back in my mind. This is how I'll tell the story when I die. I look up to the sky and point a fist and said, Kroon! I knew he'd gotten me. By the way the ad was written, Uncle Rocky. We're selling Uncle Rocky's truck and boat.
Now, did he know your wife was going to be dealing with that phone?
No.
Okay.
I had no
okay.
clue. So
all right.
I jump in the group message that I'm part of with Rob. I said, hey, something to tell me? He falls out laughing. He said, "How'd you like?"
He was wondering why it took you so long.
See, unbelievable. I did the same thing to him back to him in October. He said, "I'll pay you back. You just won't ever know it." He paid me back on the one day I don't have my phone. How does it happen?
Oh, you'll never be able to forget that one.
This is no joke, Bill. I had people calling me till 10:30 last night.
Wow.
This must be a pretty special Toyota truck and boat.
Well, Uncle Rocky was pretty well known around these parts. He took care of his equipment.
Oh, so I only suffered part of it. My wife took the brunt, stood in the way and took the brunt of Rob's groom's prank yesterday.
Wow. Poor thing. Poor thing.
So.
Oh, well.
What's happening with you?
Oh, goodness, man. We're just tripping right along. I'm planning a trip to Alabama here in a couple of weeks to take some big decision makers out fishing and tell them what coastal land loss and coastal conservation means to those of us who like to hunt and fish.
You know, an interesting topic was presented to me this morning. Not going to say who, not going to say what, or who or what company this guy was at the NWTF, what booth he was working. But Saturday, he helped work a booth. He helped work a booth on Saturday, which is the busiest day of the NWTF.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you would not imagine the number of people that came by that wanted to either be a pro staff or wanted me to tell them, which he had no clue. He said, wanted me to tell them how to get in the hunting business and make money.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know what? I said, it's kind of funny you bring that topic to me. You know, I'm on the podcast with Bill, and there's no better professional to burst a lot of bubbles today than Bill Cooksey on that topic.
Well, the old rule of thumb was all you need to do is start out with about $5 million, and that ought to get you about 3 to 5 years in business before you've lost it all. There are all kinds of jokes, and I'm sure it's that way in just about every industry about, you know, basically being a great way to go broke. And I could go through and call out some individuals over the years from failed camo companies to, you know, all kinds of different businesses that, man, it's tough. And we're just a few bad seasons or Walmart canceling a PO or you know, things like that, you're right next to bankruptcy if you aren't careful. But it's like any other business that is seasonal. And there are myriad ways you can make a living in the outdoor business if all you're trying to do is make a living. If you're trying to really make money, you better own a company. You need to go in with that mentality of starting something and building it up and then knowing when to get out. Otherwise, there are a ton of jobs. Most of the entry-level stuff won't make a lot of money, and they're going to work your tail off. But of the, I think in waterfowl, they say there are about 21,000 people whose jobs depend on waterfowl hunting. Of that 21,000, I bet maybe a couple of thousand of them could really say they hunt for a living. And the rest of them are just like everybody else. They hunt weekends and holidays. And they pay for the privilege of doing it. So, first thing I always tell people is be careful what you wish for.
I don't think, Bill, people understand. Let's talk about this main point real quick. How small of a piece of the pie, in the grand scheme of things, that the hunting industry is. It's worth hardly anything.
Yeah. You know, waterfowl, there's about 1.5 million of us who hunt. Hunters in general, I forget what the numbers are. I would have looked them up, but I didn't have this on my radar. We're a tiny fraction. On the plus side, we spend a lot of money on our sports compared to
duck hunters.
The average sport. I don't know what the numbers are now. I know about 10 years ago, the only thing that cost more as far as outdoor sports was tournament bass fishing on average than waterfowl. But obviously, as everyone knows, you can spend as much or as little as you want in these games. But to make a living on it, you got to do everything right. I mean, to really make it a go as a company, if that's what we're talking about. Not many people can guide and make a living. That's something you do part-time. As you well know, you know, most guides who do well are also farmers or, you know, construction workers. They have something else that pays them the rest of the year.
You know, when I imagined you, it's kind of like the old, what was the movie name? But anyway, you had to hit the path to the grid, to the door that led to all the prizes. You had the squares you had to perfectly jump on. That is how you make it in the hunting industry. I think that people, what confuses people from a visual perspective that's looking at this, they see such and such is hashtag Sitka, hashtag Tangle Free. You know, they think these people are getting paid. There are a few, very few.
A very few.
Very, very few that are.
A lot of them aren't even getting a discount, much less getting paid.
Right.
But if you went around at NWTF and just talked to the people working the booths, my bet, and I wasn't there, I've never been to NWTF, I'm going next year, but my bet would be the average booth has, if they have two people, one of them actually makes his living out of that company, the other one is just a pro staff volunteer that they maybe are paying expenses for, giving him some free stuff to work the booth that day. If there are three people, there's just two people he's buying lunch and giving a free turkey call to work for him that day.
I think that that's where people get it confused, because they think that somebody is a part, and you are the godfather of pro staffs. You're one of the godfathers of the pro staffs. I know that it goes all the way back to Primos, but let's just say you're sitting up on that throne realm. It's about five or six of you. You kind of help form the very first one. But, you know, people get this confused because they see such and such.
Yeah, I used to get calls and emails about our employees, and they're talking about pro staffers. You know, did you hear about your employee that got caught, you know, with untagged ducks in the bed of his truck? What employee? And they would drop a name, and it would be some guy in Ohio who has been to a few outdoor shows for us and is a pro staffer. And on that one, it turned out it was one of those BS deals. He and a buddy stopped at a gas station and then went inside the McDonald's across the street to get something to eat. And two limits of ducks from that morning are in the bed of their truck. But they were untagged, so they got a ticket. But it started off with your employee. And I'm like, no. He's not an employee. That is, he works for us at will, and we pay a per diem. So far, that's been 3 days in the last 2 years that he's actually formally gone out and done something for us for which we paid him. In that case, on that guy, and it was an outdoor rider calling me who was not a particularly good friend of mine. He's one of those that like to get gotchas. I said, no, go on record. I think the ticket's bogus. So even though he's not an employee, I'm on his side of this deal. But I would get that sort of thing all the time, not necessarily something so negative. But you're right. People think of pro staffers as employees, and most of them don't even get a per diem with most companies. Small companies, they're just having to do what they can do to get by. And everyone wants a piece of it. And it's fun, especially if you hadn't done a lot of it. Going to these shows, tuning calls, talking to people, getting invited to go hunting with folks. It can be a lot of fun. And I'm not saying a pro staff position isn't a good way to maybe find a position, an actual job in the industry. But it's a better way than nothing. But they aren't making a living.
I want to say this. The way that you, and let's say Primo's, Will or whoever helped form that one years ago with Primo's, but you guys didn't look at it back then the way that it appears now. You know.
Well, go ahead and finish that thought.
You wanted the best of the best, the top influencers. It seems to be, quote unquote, the influencer word just hit the hunting world. It was something that was talked about a lot at SHOT Show. That word influencer,
right,
came out at SHOT Show. I'm like, how does that? Is that just now hitting? That's been a huge thing for like 5 or 10 years.
Well, it has been inside too. I mean, you know, Adam Lyerly and I were talking about social media influencers for his call company 5 years ago. And that's changed some, but we also had like Cliff LaForce at Flock Knockers. He was an influencer back in the day with Goose Hunters. It was just before the kind of social media we have now. And, you know, what we did, like, certain call companies, especially, and for good reason, they have to have great callers. Not necessarily that every pro staffer has to be a competition caller, but they better be able to, you know, blow a duck call, tune a duck call, help you with a duck call. Whereas in our case, that wasn't as big a deal. We needed a guy who could go to a show. He knew what he was talking about. He understood the product. He understood how to use it. And he understood how to use it in that area.
Right.
And we looked at it, and Primos did to an extent, too. They weren't necessarily trying to get world champions. Not that that hurts you, but you wanted guys who were willing to go to events and who knew that area and knew the hunting in that area. You know,
geographical influencers. You had people that matched up geographically with that area because you didn't want – don't take – I'm not meaning this. I'm just you throwing out a name. You don't want Jim Rockwist trying to influence people in the Great Lakes region. You need to find who that guy that was looked up to the most in the Great Lakes.
Well, yeah, it's possible. It's great if they have that, if they're looked up to. The main thing is if they're knowledgeable, well-spoken, and are willing to be in that store to help people when they're looking to make the purchasing decisions. That was our need for a pro staff. Now, those needs changed and grew, and guys developed into other avenues, such as rider hunts, video stuff. I mean, there are guys now making a living out of it. Doug Steinke with his photography. But we quickly learned, and I hated this because I was a contest caller. Contest callers were about the worst guys for a pro staff. I won't be at a contest.
And all right, well, let's relate that to today. Do you know what the hunting industry is just finding out? Because somebody has a million followers on Instagram, it does not matter. It doesn't matter. You know, if I pay the huntress that has a million followers to promote my product, you think she's going to move my product? Not really. How many of those people are buyers of what she's promoting? Is she an influencer? Can she influence their decision? No. Companies have wasted 3 or 4 years buying up social media followers mm-hmm. through people that have no influence.
I agree with that. I mean, I think there are influencers who do help, for sure. But it's just like any advertising. If it's not targeted, especially in this business, if it's not targeted, it's like trying to sell baseball equipment in a golf store. You know, I mean, it's not what people are going there for. You don't advertise your duck hunting stuff in, you know, deer and deer hunting. You go to Wildfowl, you go to Ducks Unlimited, you go, and people say, well, there aren't that many readers of Wildfowl. Yeah, but every dang one of them, you're only paying for the readers they have, and every one of them is a duck hunter. DU's almost that good. They're not quite as high a ratio of hunters, but it's still the vast majority of members getting that magazine are duck hunters, and that's your clientele. And it's the same with people on social media. What one guy says may have a big impact with certain waterfowlers, certainly not all, because it doesn't matter who you are, somebody hates you. But some people would have a lot of impact with enough to make it worth doing something with those people. Other folks, don't matter at all. The numbers look good, but they're not the people you need.
Right. That's what I'm saying. You take person A, they may have 1.5 million followers. For person mm-hmm. B, highly respected, and he has 500,000 followers. Just, you know, not going to, yeah. Let's not use the social media, but look, you know, I want the guy that's going to end, his return may be 30%, 150,000. That one with 1.5 million may not be but 3%, which is the national average on just a general, you know, when it comes to that. Yeah. So that wouldn't be but 45,000, right?
Right.
I want the guy that's going to move the needle.
It's all a matter of cost per thousand. You're going to pay the same for people who will never be customers as what you pay for people who will be or could be. So spend a little time and figure out who's going to deliver those people.
Why? Let me just ask you this, and I'll end with this question. Why does it seem, when it comes to general marketing, that the hunting industry is always a few years behind? Couple of years.
For one, most of the people in the hunting industry don't necessarily have the business background that you would have if you had that same job in another industry, a bigger industry. Not all these marketing people have some high-end marketing degree and a big marketing background. You know, a lot of them, they've had to learn on the go, and you're also nowadays learning in such a rapidly changing environment as far as marketing, where when I first got in it, there were a few videos, there was almost no television, you know, hunting television, a few videos, and the magazines and newspapers. The writers were your big avenue for press. And to get in front of people, and buying ads in those magazines was what got you the good will of the publisher to help get you more articles within those magazines. No one says that, but that's the way it is. If you don't support the magazine, eventually they can't keep supporting you, and vice versa. And that's not good or bad, it just is, and it's that way all over the world in every business. But it was pretty simple. If you had a good personality and were willing to just call and talk to writers, invite writers on hunt, send stuff to people, and build those relationships, it was a pretty simple deal. It's not so simple anymore. And, you know, the internet changed everything, and I think still no one's quite sure how all this stuff works or how to make it work. And about the time you think you have a handle on it, it changes. Facebook is making changes right now that are making it really tough on nonprofits. Really tough.
I'll say this. It still goes back to the basic principle. Give people lots of good info. They buy from you. That's a simple combination. Give people good info. They'll buy from you.
Be the expert
in your field. You want to make money in the hunting industry, become an expert in a certain topic and make a product representing that expertise.
Mm-hmm. And before you do, figure out how you want to sell it.
That's right. A lot of steps left out in between there.
Well, and that's a more fair question, and there's really more opportunity today than there has ever been because of the internet to start a company and sell products direct to consumers without going through the traditional avenues of distributors and dealers and shipping seasons and all and rep groups and all those things. It's, as you know, it's more possible than it ever has been for a guy to start a business and manage it without having to have all that stuff. But that's never going to be, I don't see that becoming a millionaire. You know, that's not a guy that's, unless that model changes at some point, you know, you're not going to end up with a $30 million a year in sales company that you can, you know, sell and write off into the sunset.
Wake up and do what you love every day.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we enjoy the things that we're experts in.
Yeah.
And when we're able to wake up and talk about those and do those every day, it makes for a peaceful life.
Sure it does. I tell people all the time, it's just like any other job. In what your responsibilities are and the nuts and bolts of it, but at least you're getting to talk about something you care about every day. I mean, don't get me wrong, I don't like talking about the composition of plastics and decoys. That gets a little bit painful, but
but that's just
like
you
decoys.
And what you get to do every day. You know, there you mm-hmm. see somebody that gets to talk to you couple of times a week, you see a joy in being able to do, you feel like you're making a change, and not just feel, but you are, but you wake up and do what you love every day. You're making a difference. You're making
right.
a living by doing what you love.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I want to ask you
it's
this.
It's out there for, I've for years thought, man, if I could get my stuff together, what you're doing, I think, is awesome. You and I know some other people within the industry with a similar business model going, and it's exciting. It's fun for me to watch because I was so geared to the old, build it, warehouse it, have some salesmen that drive around and sell it, ship it out on a certain day, and our marketing was so the consumer would buy it at that store or would ask the store for it so he knew who we were when we came in. And, well, that's an onerous thing for a guy to start up.
Oh, that Spencer Halford model.
Yeah. And it's still viable.
That. Yes, it is, big time.
But you better be prepared, both time and financially, because it's not a cheap way to get a business going.
Hey, let me
ask
you
this. You got to pay a lot of people.
Larger the cost, larger the profit margin on an item, the more, I'm not going to say the more you're willing to put out to an influencer, but you're going to make sure that you put that into somebody's hands that's going to convert for you. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
If you're talking about a $5 turkey call, I can go get Joe to blow that, and we can film a hunt killing a turkey with that call, blow it up on social media, no big deal. But
mm-hmm.
something that you are going all in on, $400 jacket, $900 waders, you better believe I've got a marketing budget there for somebody that has some influence.
Yeah. And it's, you know, that influence is a bigger thing than it used to be because magazines aren't as big a thing. Television's not as big a thing. I mean, there's so many ways people get their news. An old saying I always heard, and there was tons of truth in it until now, is people buy what's on the shelf. 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, I still held to that. I mean, there were other business models that somewhat worked, but that was, if you weren't on dealer shelves, you were never more than an also-ran. And you were very limited in the number of people that would ever hear of you. If it was on store shelves, people bought it, whether it was decoys or waders or jackets or whatever. So not just marketing to the consumer, but the people who were best at selling to dealers.
Does that touch it, feel it?
Hmm?
Because they're able to touch it and feel it in store, in a dealer?
Well, there's that, but also it was more difficult to, you know, it wasn't as easy to find stuff other than, yeah, you had your catalogs. But outside of that, it was not that easy to go, you know, especially you get more than 10 years ago, it wasn't as easy to find everything online, and it was generally expensive shipping. And I mean, let's face it, if you're willing to go on a computer and buy stuff now, I know people that never set foot in a store. I still prefer a store. But that's slowly changing. I find myself ordering more and more. So that process has changed. But your stuff has to be available, and it has to be known about by consumers more so now than ever in the past. Because if we had the only decoys, if our decoys were on the shelf in Bass Pro in Memphis, they're going to sell to the people that come in that store. If they aren't on the shelf at Bass Pro in Memphis, and for years that's basically been the only sporting goods store in Memphis, for years that's the way it was, if they weren't on the shelf, we weren't selling decoys in Memphis, Tennessee.
And that's a huge market.
But that's changed to some extent. Hunting years ago with the boot guy at Cabela's, we were duck hunting at Real Foot. He looked at my little lacrosse breathables when they had first come out. He said, what would it take to get you in some Cabela's waders? I said, it would take y'all selling them in Max, I guess, because I'd want to try them on before I'd buy the damn things. And I said it meaning it to be funny, and he got a kick out of it. But
right,
there was truth to that, too.
I agree with that.
You
don't make
but that attitude
changes a lot of, yeah, but still, you still don't make large purchases. I still think that line is about $300, $250. You get what I'm saying? That
yeah,
for somebody to hear whatever it may be, they still want to just kind of same. What you're talking about. They want to touch it, feel it, see it, try it on, whatever mm-hmm. it may be, before they spend that kind of money.
Yeah. And on the opposite end, and I find myself doing this all the time, if I know I want to buy a certain something, I go online and see who stocks it around me. Because if I can go pick it up, I'll do that versus ordering. But I'm not going to go to Academy and Dick's and Bass Pro hoping one of them has it. I'll check ahead. And if they don't carry them, and it only takes me about a minute and a half online to check all three stores, then I'll order it from somewhere.
I guess
that's especially true with things like ammo, guns, decoys, you know, items that size and fit doesn't matter.
I will end it by saying this. You want to get paid in the hunting industry, better become an influencer. That's all I got to say. That's the first. That is the first step. You better gain some type of influence.
Yeah. And good luck, because it ain't easy.
No, it's not at all. Not at all. I thought that that would be something interesting for you to tackle for us today. Mm-hmm. So, hey,
absolutely.
Let's talk about this. Let's talk about this a few minutes before we go, as we're getting close to the end. And we'll finish it all next week. But your last couple of years with Avery.
Mm-hmm.
How did you see that all unfolding, that, you know, that you were going to exit from working with them?
Well, you just watch the changes within a company. And a lot of it had to do with external changes we had no control over. As far as marketing, that sort of thing. Watching how things were transitioning with social media, with pro staff, with writers, et cetera, I saw my position, and I see this now at Avery and other places. The marketing people aren't as key as they used to be. At least in a traditional role, if they haven't morphed into more than just the guy who makes sure you're in all the magazines and sponsor the right programs, that sort of thing. If that's all you are, you've probably been marginalized, because those types of marketing have become less important. They're still important, but they're not as quick, and frankly aren't even seen by a lot of people the way social media stuff is. I saw that occurring. I saw some of my good friends who I'd worked there for years leave and start Banded. And other things changing within the industry, and just when things were right. And another thing, and this is something people need to know about the outdoor business. If you're going to be someone in it, be prepared to make a lot of sacrifices at home. And at that time, you know, my son was in school. My wife had an extraordinarily demanding job that required a lot of travel. And it was getting harder and harder for me to meet my work obligations. So, I went from, at one point, I was traveling over 150 nights a year in that business. So I couldn't do that anymore, and ended up just moving on.
That is one topic I don't know why, never talked about, you never hear about, but when you get in personal situations with some of these guys, what they talk about. You better put a value on family before you jump off in there. You better say, man, what's the value on my family? Because I'm going to be around hardly any. I'm not going to be around hardly any.
You have to be good with that, and your spouse has to be good with that. Whether it's professional fishermen or duck guides or guys working at a company that require them to go to all the events and shows and various hunts with media and et cetera, you're gone a lot. And if your spouse isn't good with that, life's going to be miserable if you even stay together.
Man, that is a great
I don't know what the divorce
rate
is, but I bet it's higher than most professions.
Great topic that's never talked about in public ever in this industry. Jeez.
And you got to remember, they know you love what you're doing when you're gone. So that's usually even some extra salt in the wounds.
Yep.
My favorite outdoor writer, his wife shot him twice. Gene Hill, who's passed away now, his wife, he came home from somewhere, some trip. She shot him with a shotgun. Didn't hurt him bad. And they kept that one out of the media. And about 15 years later, she hit him a little bit better, and they couldn't keep that one out. So she just knew he was out having fun, and she was stuck at home.
You got to put the thing on the scales, old timey scales.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what are those scales called that get the cups on each side? Kind of a
Well, you got the scales of justice, but yeah, what do you call that? I forget.
Can't remember.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, you put the beans yeah. on as you weigh it out.
Mm-hmm.
Me, I've always thought about it. I'm not going to sit here and say I had busted open, wide open opportunities to jump head over heels into that. There's been doors, but man, my dad killed himself 5 in the morning to 8 or 9 every night. Made a great living. On his deathbed, he looked at me and he said, "Promise me one thing. You'll spend as much time," at that time I didn't have but girls, "with your children, your kids, your girls, that I didn't with you." I said, "I will." Yeah, we real close to there, you know, the last 20 years of his life, don't get me wrong, but when we were kids, when I was an influencer upon them, or when he was, he wasn't around a lot.
Yeah.
And that was always his biggest regret, he would say.
Right.
And it goes back to what you said. You get money that you make, sacrifice your family, it's a joke. It does not
right.
weigh out. You're
yeah.
talking 40 or 30, 40, and I'm not putting down any amount of money. I'm saying some of these guys making 30, 40, 50,000 a year. To be gone all the time away from their family.
Right.
Then that amount of money outweighs your kids and your wife. Go at it. But it's not worth it to me.
I know with what I was doing at 40, if I could have done it at 25, good night. I could have been gone 200 days a year and been loving every minute of it. But those things change. Oh, they do for some of us anyway.
No.
Right, now my wife and son would still both say I travel too much and enjoy what I do too much. But,
but it seems like it always works out for those people. There's a window. From, you get married at the average age, have kids at the average age, there's a window that presents opportunities for husbands and fathers.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's before that window or after that window, you're good. You're good. But usually on the before end, you don't have the influence of people don't want you.
Right.
On the latter end, it usually works out.
Mm-hmm.
But you get to the point at age, just like Will tells me, and I don't want to be gone from home.
Right. But to give people an idea, before I married Nina, I ran field trials and hunt tests. I trained retrievers all the time. I mean, that was kind of my main hobby. And I blew in duck calling contests. Loved duck calling contests. Shot a little bit of sporting clays competition, but not at a high level. But I was always doing that stuff. Got married, went to work at Avery, suddenly had all kinds of responsibilities with work and with home. And I never ran another field trial or hunt test. Judged one or two and haven't done that in 20 years. Blew in calling contests for a few years after that. Didn't really have time to focus on it. I've shot sporting clays probably 10 times in the last 20 years. And I had to make a choice. And I gave up a lot of things I really, really enjoyed doing that were a huge part of my life. So that I could have some balance of career and family.
Well, hey, look, let's plan on this next week. For everybody that's listening, let's talk about those last couple of years you were there at Avery. We'll spend a little bit of time on that. And then I want you to take a little outside view after you left. Outside view looking in, looking down.
Okay.
On, you know, because Avery was the king of the hill, king of the mountain for so long. And that authority, influence, it shifted. What caused that? What happened? Let's talk about that next week.
Okay.
So.
Okay.
All right, Bill. Man, like I said, I knew if anybody could give expertise in that topic about how to make money, I want to make money in the hunting industry. No better person to give it than you.
And folks, don't, if you have young folks going to, off to school and making these decisions, don't discount the conservation world. There are a lot of careers out there for the right person that can be pretty dang solid.
What percentage of those people that want to get in the hunting industry want to be in front of a camera hunting?
Yeah, I don't know if it's as bad as it used to be. Just because now everyone has a camera all the time, so it's not as, you know, what's the big deal? You're being filmed and put online. But there for a while, it's all anyone wanted. Just like for years, everybody wanted to be an outdoor writer. Then videos came along, everybody wanted to be a video star. And I imagine still people want to be a television star. I did too until I shot my first show, and then I said, I hate this. Best way to ruin a good duck hunt is bring out a camera.
All right, well, Bill, look, I've really enjoyed this week. Really enjoyed the topic. Look forward to next week. Thank you again for being here. I really appreciate it.
Glad to do it, brother.
We want to thank all of you that listened to this edition of the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.